welcome back to Projector Room, our podcast, which we do every fortnight and talk about films, cinema and TV in the usual way. Gareth and Alan are with me as usual. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Oh, yeah, I'm all right, thank you. I'm fine, thank you. And Gareth, all right, too?
Just about. My voice is going a wee bit from
shouting. Oh, my word. A prerequisite for podcasting, so bit of a damp squib on that one then. Projectorroom.co.uk is our website where you'll find links to all the stuff we're going to be talking about on this show. And also all of that stuff should be in your podcatcher, of course. MeWe is where we hang out though, mostly, and you can find out all about what we're doing there, and we will invite you to join in and bring your reviews so we can bring them to the show and natter about them like we're doing now. I watched Frankenstein this week. Frankenstein.
Oh, right, yeah, how'd you get on?
Del Toro's Frankenstein. And I think I need to watch it again because I'm not really quite convinced. I kept thinking back to the Kenneth Branagh one and the Robert De Niro one for, you know, the 1994 one, and I just kept thinking, I'm really not enjoying this so much. I couldn't quite work out why, but to be fair, it's been quite a long time since I saw the Branagh one. The trouble was that the Kenneth Branagh one got lots of bad press, and I think I'm one of the few people that liked it, but I don't know. I mean, there's no doubt that Del Toro has created something of a lavish mix of great cinematography and scenery and atmosphere, but also, if you see this, either of you, some dodgy-looking CGI, I reckon. There was a scene where a pack of wolves turned up, and they looked like they were from Bird... What's that thing called? Birdageddon. No, Bird...
Oh, Birdemic.
Yeah. It looked almost a bit like that, you know, and I thought, come on, this is supposed to be a big-budget production, and you're putting this crappy CGI in.
To be clear, that's in the Del Toro one.
This is in this one. Wow, and it's just not very good. And there was another place as well, which I can't bring to mind, where there was some dodgy CGI as well. And I just thought, there was some character and role inconsistencies, and there just wasn't a kind of build-out on the characters and their motives and why they were doing some of the stuff they were doing. It was pretty well acted, I think, by everyone. Well, maybe not Mia Goth, but Christoph Waltz was just great, and he's not in it a huge amount, but he's worth the viewing on his own, as usual. I'm not really sure. I'm not convinced for some reason, but as I say, perhaps I should watch it again and be convinced. And I threw it, Gareth, open to the group, and we got some feedback from them, didn't we?
Did we? Oh, so we did. Well, Troy has written in about it, saying that he really liked the original too. Shame everyone else except Ted and I hated it. Yeah, that seems to be about right. Irfan Ali said, I enjoyed it. I felt sorry for the monster. It's well written, acted, and looked amazing. And then Joe Hickey, the man from the camera podcast, he liked it too. I see what you mean about the CGI wolves. Visually, it's wonderful, especially the scenes of the ship on the ice and that amazing building he works from. However, the monster was a little too good. A little too good looking, considering he was built from dead body parts. Worth a watch, especially for Mia Goth. Thank you very much for all of that feedback. I do recommend Bride of Reanimator as an alternative here.
Right.
Right. Insert derisory gesture. Shall we proceed?
Have you seen the dodgy CGI on this film yet?
No, but I've seen Twitter and people talking about it,
right?
Saying about Netflix slashing budgets and things like that too, in order to bring things down a bit in price, and the films are ultimately suffering for that.
Still a chunky budget. It's Del Toro, isn't it? So Frankenstein, Del Toro. I'm just looking it up here, hence the clattering that you'll hear over your speakers. Frankenstein, Del Toro, Wolves. Let's see what YouTube can give us. Come on, baby. Let's see.
No particular hurry.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you what, I will report back if I can see anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think you should watch it though, if you can, both of you, and form your own opinion, because I think essentially it was actually quite good, but I just think that the previous one was better. Perhaps I should watch that one as well.
I think he's undoubtedly an amazing filmmaker. And a genuine artist. Like, I was watching something about him this morning. He was talking about the building of the set and some of the practical props and all the rest of it. And just listening to the man talk, I mean, it was so inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't particularly enamored with the trailer when I watched it. I didn't like the Branagh one at all. But I would certainly like to see Del Toro's work just from the point of view, like, what an extraordinary filmmaker he is, the caliber of artists and all the rest of it. So if nothing else, it'll be an interesting piece of filmmaking.
I think that Robert De Niro was a much more convincing monster than this chappie,
right?
Who I can't remember the name of. I think he just played it better. But then, he's bound to, isn't he? Because he's so
well.
Cool.
We're going to come back to him later on.
Okay.
In tonight's show as well.
Right.
So, Chad has a report for us. Do you want to? Yep. Shall I hop onto that?
Yep.
So thanks, Chad, for your report on One Battle After Another 2025. So Chad says, Paul Thomas Anderson's action thriller is inspired by Thomas Pynchon's novel Vineland and features a stellar cast in a non-specific contemporary USA setting. The film centres on the far-left revolutionary group, the French 75, led by the enthusiastic but inept explosives expert Pat Calhoun, played by DiCaprio, and his wild, fearless girlfriend, Perfidia Beverly Hills, played by Tiana Taylor. Great name.
What a name.
Yeah, absolutely. The action begins with a successful, overwhelming raid on a detention camp near the Mexican border to liberate all the migrants. During the raid, Perfidia confronts the camp commandant, the kooky Colonel Stephen J. Lockjaw, played by Sean Penn, in a half-mocking, half-sexual encounter. Later, a subsequent mission sees Perfidia caught by Lockjaw while planting a bomb, which inexplicably leads to a rough, steamy hookup between them. The film then jumps 16 years later, where Pat, now Bob Ferguson, is in hiding. His confident teenage daughter, Willa Ferguson, played by Chase Infinity, there's another outlandish name, Chase Infinity, it sounds like an episode of Star Trek New Generation, is training in karate. On Willa's high school dance night, the authorities, led by Colonel Lockjaw, show up. Willa is saved by a mysterious black woman named Deandra, played by Regina Hall, an old compatriot of her father's, and the two flee. The movie is packed with action, including an awesomely tense car chase. Tiana Taylor is noted as the star of the first act, while Chase Infinity is hailed as the film's overall standout. The film has an energetic pace and Quentin Tarantino-esque cinematography, making the nearly three-hour runtime fly by. Sean Penn's bizarre portrayal of Colonel Lockjaw also adds a quirky layer to the film's larger-than-life characters. Thanks a million, Chad. That was a very vibrant review. And I have watched a couple of reviews on it. I watched the trailer. I hate this film. I'm just going to nail my colours to the mast, just on the politics alone. And it's a bit unfortunate because I love Paul Thomas Anderson's other work for the main part, especially we talked about Boogie Nights recently, which I think is a genuine masterpiece. But, I often think, like, Hollywood just absolutely adores the left. Now, can you imagine if they had made the same film with the same cast, but just did it on the other side of the political spectrum? And none of them would have worked again. So it would be kind of like, it's a form of sort of inverse McCarthyism. I find it just really hypocritical and tedious. But by all accounts, the car chases, the action scenes and so forth are absolutely terrific. And there's, I think as Chad was pointing out, there's a fairly broad spectrum of colourful performances. And, a number of people have remarked upon the Sean Penn character being just like a complete space cadet, which might be very entertaining. But it does seem to be caricature. And again, if the shoe was on the other foot, a lot of people quite rightly would be saying this is wildly inappropriate and completely offensive politically. But there you have it. Have either of you guys seen it, or what are your thoughts?
No, oh, I haven't seen it. I didn't realize the politics were such a big part of it. I just thought it looked like a very solid, interesting kind of Western thriller or modern Western thriller. I do love these types of, you know, desert tension thrillers. And I've even got one down in the coming soon section just for that type of film. But
yeah,
I'll watch it. And I'm very good at watching it whilst being completely ignorant of the politics at play. I'm hoping that we get Benicio del Toro doing something kind of Sicario-esque.
Right. Absolutely. He was terrific in that.
He doesn't seem to have any top billing at all in this. His name is way down the list, isn't it?
But it's a new movie. Sometimes IMDb does that where they haven't got it numbered, or they haven't got the numbers put in, because if you look, Sean Penn's like down at number 12, right, in behind the person who plays Sylvia and doesn't have a picture.
Right, it might be in order of appearance, or who knows how they calibrate these things. Yeah. But
just to mention that that is an excerpt from Chaz Full review, which I posted on my blog, and he's put into his Blue Sky.
Did it also have a 3.5-hour duration?
It's a good review. It's worth a read. We don't always have all the time to read all out on the show, but Chad's churning out almost as many reviews these days as Gareth is. Right, next up is Phil Harding, and he's been watching IT, Welcome to Derry, 2025. This is on Sky and Now TV from Sky. This is the prequel series to the Bill Skarsgård starring films based on Stephen King's It from a few years ago. Starting on a positive note, the setting is the early 1960s, says Phil, an era which seems to inspire King's best work. The story follows an earlier generation of losers. The opening scene starts well. A young boy hitches a ride with a wholesome all-American family. He soon starts to feel anxious as the family conversation turns increasingly inappropriate. This works well, and it's classic King. That is, until the mother in the front seat spontaneously gives birth to a demonic CGI cherub, which proceeds to tear up the occupants of the car. Oh well, says Phil, it was good while it lasted. I'm only 2 episodes in, and I'm not sure if I'll continue. That said, I'm fully aware that this isn't aimed at me. The teens and 20-somethings who made the It films, so successfully will no doubt lap this up. I should make it clear that Stephen King doesn't seem to be involved in this in any way other than having provided the source material with his pen. Gareth, fancy this?
No, I actually haven't seen the first 2 films either. I did watch the original miniseries with Tim Curry when it came out in Channel 4. I don't think I watched it the original time. I think I watched it when it was replayed or something. And it really felt hokey, but I don't get excited over Stephen King anymore. I'm actually going to say that John Carpenter ruined Stephen King with In the Mouth of Madness. And I started thinking about Stephen King that way and looking into it and, you know, pseudonyms and ghostwriting and all that kind of stuff. And the way he just can't end the story well. So I have no desire to see this, really. And it's called Welcome to Derry / Londonderry. I think that should be more appropriately titled.
Given that we've both been to Derry, it's a terrifying, you know, they've got aspects of it right.
This is,
I've been to both Derrys, the one here and the one in the States.
This is just to point out, this is a series, not a film, which means there's an even greater demand on time to get through it. Anyway, we'll see if anyone fancies picking up on that one. While we head for Flop of the Fortnight, and I'm going to throw into Flop of the Fortnight, Beast of War. And this is a bit of a shame, really, because this is an Australian film. Have you seen it, Gareth?
No, I want to. It's high. I think we had it in coming soon, some months ago.
Yeah, we did. That's right. And I think it's a bit of a shame, this, because this is supposed to be a true story about this Australian group of soldiers in 1942 who end up out on the sea with the Japanese sinking their ship. They end up on a raft, a makeshift raft, floating around in the sea, waiting to be rescued. There's thick fog, and then suddenly a great white appears and starts terrorizing them and starts chomping them up one by one. And there's lots of gore and blood and guts, and all the budget seems to have been spent on the gore, as is often the case. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Apart from anything else, I did a bit of research on the background of this story. They painted it up as based on a true story, but apparently there's no truth in this story at all. There was no shark.
Not this again.
There's no shark at all. It was true that this boat got shot down by the Japanese in the waters, and these poor Australian sailors had to survive for weeks on end on these rafts in the middle of the water. But there was no shark involved. That was the truth, and the filmmakers have made it into a big drama. But the biggest problem I have with this, and maybe Alan, this will appeal to your knowledge,
sensibilities,
your knowledge of filmmaking, really, is that it felt like it was a documentary almost, and that it was made in a studio. So they're on this water, on this raft, and the water is kind of moving. Now, okay, it was a still situation with a fog, and there wasn't much movement. But in the middle of this sea, the water was moving, but the raft they're sitting on was absolutely held solid. It didn't move a millimetre. Oh, it was so obviously held in the studio from underneath in place. And it's like, what?
I think we actually commented on that when we were doing the coming soon. I think we sort of said, look, you know, if you're going to do ocean, you know, scenes and all the rest of it, be aware that that's a very, very difficult thing to pull off technically. So it sounds like they resoundingly failed.
Yeah, they certainly did. And it just comes across as a low-budget documentary that's been made for TV. And I did notice on IMDb, there was at the top, it kind of said docu-something. So maybe it wasn't supposed to be a proper film, inverted commas.
Maybe it was supposed to look dreadful visually.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then someone's just made what, you know, the bones of a story about a poor bunch of soldiers in this survival situation into a shark film, Gareth.
Yes, well, all heads turned to Gareth.
You know the thing about a shark? He's got lifeless eyes, black eyes like doll's eyes when he comes at you. Doesn't seem to be living until he bites you. Those black eyes roll over white, and then, oh, you hear that high, terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and spirit of the pounding and the hollering as they come at you and rip you to pieces.
Dude, excellent.
Sorry, I'm like to pull that out every now and again, especially whenever you're having coffee and work.
Yeah. How's your week been? Oh, them dead eyes. Yeah, excellent, man.
So does this disappoint you too?
No, I'm going to give it a go. I think it looks quite superb. I had real high hopes that it was going to be something, you know, they never, well, they did make a film about, you know, obviously Robert Shaw and Jaws gives that speech about the Indianapolis, that is still the most terrifying motion picture event based around the Indianapolis, bar none. I know Nicolas Cage made a film about it, and it was woeful. But I wanted this to be somewhere in between. You know, it was almost that kind of story, and maybe they took their inspiration from that. I don't mind that, you know, it's just based around a true story, and they've thrown sharks in just to jazz it up. Because it's not a true story that people are going to be particularly precious about, but you know, I'll give it a go. It seems in my wheelhouse, and
some of the chance
to look at those doll's eyes.
So, yeah, some of the you're like the footage of the sharks, and this is no 1975 Jaws, Jaws machine, shark machine. Some of the special effects are actually that's where the money's gone. You can see it has, and some of the shark scenes are actually quite good. It's just the rest of it.
You know, I have a fairly low bar whenever it comes to movies. You know, 99% of them now are just shit. So if this is a wee bit better than that, sure.
Right, okay, you come back later and drag it out of Flop of the Fortnight.
Aye, I will. I don't know why I'm doing it like the fisherman from The Simpsons. I didn't really think that through.
They're presumably modelled on the same character, aren't they?
Hopefully. Possibly.
Yeah, I would imagine
that or Captain Bird. What, the bird's eye? No, he's too friendly. I've been watching, kind of a mistake, I suppose, because of his age, but I've been watching the National Lampoon's Vacation movies with my son. And I got the 4K of the original some time ago, and we watched it, and he enjoyed it very much, because it's just Chevy Chase and John Candy and people, and it's just great. So we got around to watching National Lampoon's European Vacation, and from memory I thought this was great when I was a kid, but watching it back as an adult, oh boy, is this such a bad movie. It's it has nothing of the original freshness of the original film. You know, just how funny and savage the original one could be. This one is just, you know, basic gags straight away. You know, there is nothing creative or towing the line anywhere in this. It is just basic comedy. Eric Idle is in this, he's in it for 5 minutes or something like that, and gets third billing or whatever. But he's utterly unfunny as well, which I suppose most things that Eric Idle does that's outside of Monty Python are generally unfunny. Save for the Ruttles, perhaps.
I remember watching that way back. Yeah,
I really struggled to find anything that was slightly humorous in this film. It really didn't. I appreciated the scope and the value of it and what they tried to do, but whenever it boiled down to being a comedy, it's not funny. It really is not. And Chevy Chase is actually kind of annoying in it, because they hadn't quite honed the character, but it is one of those sequels that's merged between two really good sequels, or two really good entries to the franchise, because Christmas Vacation is an utter classic that is a wee bit overrated, I think, by some people, and then the original movie is just, you know, that instrumental comedy that changed comedy, I think, during the 80s. And then Vegas Vacation's had slightly better than this from memory. But I think that'll be the last time I ever give European Vacation a chance. And I'm a big fan of Beverly D'Angelo because I grew up with her being utterly gorgeous. And I can't face watching the game. Either of you two seen this at all recently, or is it childhood memories?
The old one I saw like about a decade ago, I think, for the first time. And I quite enjoyed it, but I think a lot of it was context. It was, you know, with a few beers and with my girlfriend, and it was just a sort of fun night watching a film that she had loved way back in the day. But I much prefer Chevy Chase's work in Community, which really had me splitting with laughter. And the other ones were just kind of like, I could see the appeal and I enjoyed them, but I didn't think they were, you know, outrageously good in the kind of John Candy way or anything like that.
Well, you know, the John Candy was brought in at a later date, you know, because they'd filmed the ending and went, nah, this isn't good enough, and they needed something else, so they brought in John Candy, and he...
I didn't know that.
No, it was just tacked on at the last minute.
Right, okay. We moly.
I think we previously spoke about the Christmas one, and I seem to remember watching that, and I thought that was quite good as well, actually. And this is really, really, as you know, not my kind of genre, but that Christmas one, I did think it was quite good.
Hey, well, there you go. And this one has, no, it hasn't got any nudity in it at all, so you wouldn't like it.
Oh, blimey. Right. Let's move on to private screening then. Swiftly, and Gareth, you challenged us to a remake? No, an adaptation.
Well, yes, because it was doing the rounds and people are talking about it, so I figured, why not? Because I have the TV streaming service that this is on, is Disney currently, and yeah, it was Hulu. Sorry, it goes out in Hulu, which goes out. And I'm a big fan of the original, and I wanted to see if this was just going to be one of those painful remakes, because I'd seen a lot of mixed reviews and people saying that it was worth it. And I believe, Ted, you even said that there was a good conversation going on in MeWe about things that they tried to do with this. So I challenge the two of you to give it a go. And first of all, we'll accept Alan's note from his parents.
So essentially, this does come under that thing, you know, you're talking about previously of the kind of the questionable remake. Like, why exactly did we do this? The original is held in high regard. I suppose I'm answering my own question. The original is held in high regard and sufficient time has passed that people can remarket it, is the answer. But I think if you're going to remarket it, it needs to be of marketable quality. And the sense I get from it is very much that it's barely an adequate TV sort of movie. And it has the same sort of, you know, budget basement, you know, kind of lack of production value. Yeah. You're kind of hampered by a very strong performance in the original from Rebecca De Mornay in particular and Annabelle Sciorra. But much as I like the leading actor, whose name I forget, he's also in Tulsa King, where he's excellent. Can you remember the name of that guy? You know, funny. Yeah.
The remake or the...
In the remake, yeah.
Raul Callisto?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think he's terrific in Tulsa King, but it feels a bit kind of flat. The shoehorned lesbian narrative is shoehorned. And some the other components, I think the music was sort of criticized for being very on the nose and, you know, a bit distracting and stuff. Yeah, it just looks like a barely adequate TV rinse and repeat. So not a big fan.
What about Ted? Ted, this, I actually think this is the kind of thing that you would really enjoy, the kind of psychological thriller side of things and a fruit bar doing nasty things to a family.
Yeah, I did like it, and I'll present the other side of it, because they said it was an adaptation and not a remake of the original, but in many ways it felt very similar to me. I don't think they were trying to copy it, you know, scene for scene or anything, but there was apart from the intellectually challenged gardener that was in the original, that thread of the story was not there at all. But apart from that, I thought it was quite close to it, but I really enjoyed it. Not brilliant, but it was certainly very well done. Really well, I thought it was well produced and well shot and acted by everyone. I really like Maker Monroe. She made the kind of nasty nanny character look sinister and menacing right from the outset. I thought they were using great close focus to help with that, zooming in on her eyes and her head and long shots around her. It was really. I thought that they had cast her really well, and she did a good job in trying to be that menacing, sinister, nasty person. And also there was Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who was almost unrecognisable from the Fargo days. I was trying to picture her when she was in Fargo, and she just looks, she must have been just so much younger then, and she was just looked very different. But she was excellent too, I thought. And I think the two leads, the two leading ladies, battled this out really well. She was the kind of woman in the middle, obviously, and the audience has to work out if she's nuts or not, which is very much the same as the first one. And also the little Mexican girl, she was really good, I thought. She played her part really well as the daughter in the middle of everything. I thought suspense was present in the right places. It was edgy. It was unsettling. And especially towards the end when the outcomes unfolded and there was some good music going on in the background there, which probably weren't in just in the trailer. The violence was pretty well orchestrated, I thought, especially when the baseball bat got involved. Blimey. This is where Maker Monroe went crazy ape shit. There were no big twists really. And anyone could see it coming, especially as there was an opening scene right at the beginning of the film that kind of led you into what had happened in the past. But bit by bit, the truth came out. I thought it was well paced, and I thought it was, yeah, a pretty good, not brilliant, but a pretty good 90s style thriller. And I thought it was a fair shot at the original The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. Not as good, but it was a really good shot, and I'm going to give it 8. Gareth?
Oh, fair enough. Well, I do tend to disagree with you. I'm more on the side of what Alan was pointing out.
Yo!
being a fan of the original, I think it's a very well-constructed remake in that it's difficult to compare it to the original, despite the fact it bears the name of the original. But I'm saying the original, actually, which is not... that's not fair to do that, because... the original Hand That Rocks the Cradle was actually from 1919, and it's a very lost film that was about...
Wow, the original?
It was another film about teaching women how to get rid of the child that they might be bearing. as a result, it was removed, but it's people are desperately seeking it because it's actually kind of an important film for the time. Yeah. But the 1992 version, which probably just bears the same name as opposed to being anything close to a similar story. I feel that, you know, it's just much more accomplished movie, right from the very opening, because I watched the original the night before I watched the remake, and you are introduced to the house and the family that is going through the motions in The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, with Graham Revell's orchestral score, which just sweeps in, and it's wonderful, and it's actually a rendition of Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance, which is something that they play throughout the movie. You know, the alarm clock has the same thing, and then there's a cassette of it as well, and then Matt McCoy sings it whilst he's shaving to the little girl. So it has that going for it, and it keeps that throughout. And you compare that to the music, as Alan was saying, with the Hand That Rocks the Cradle remake, and there's nothing memorable there in the slightest. Ted, there might be one little bit of one little piece toward the end that's a wee bit kind of but you know, there's no sound design there that is in any way memorable in the slightest. And I was looking for it, and I was just like, this is bland, so very bland. Micah Monroe, I am a really big fan of. I've seen her in a number of things because of Watcher, and there was a great alien.
Watcher.
There's a pretty great sort of alien invasion movie set out in the forests of, I don't know, Oregon or somewhere like that, where she and a fella are running around with an alien invasion going on, which is really cool. And it's such a small movie that I can't even remember what it's called, but it took me a moment to actually place the two together. I was like, I love that film, and I love that film, so I love her. And she is great here, and it really goes to show just how damn good she is here, because
with the language, there's no call for that.
Well, there's just that moment, and Ted, I'm sure you noticed it as well, where she's sitting on the sofa and her face changes when she wakes up. She is this psycho host beast, and then she just turns back to the likable character that she's trying to be in front of this family. And you just get to see, this is an actress that we need to see more of. Mary Elizabeth Winstead was kind of forgettable in this, and it's kind of a thankless role for her as well, because there's nothing too exciting about it. But you know, they really did ramp up that character to to take away any form of male neediness to relieve the situation. You know, she solves all of this herself, and she's got the balls to be able to do it. Whereas in the original, you know, Matt McCoy's character, she relies, his wife, Annabelle, relies very heavily on him for certain things until she's pushed to it. And the omission of Ernie Hudson from the original film is really unfair, because that's one of the big draws of that original film, because his performance is superb. Mm-hmm. And he's so memorable as well, and you really feel for him and everything that he goes through, because he's not able to handle what's going on, but he tries, because he loves these people so much. They've been so kind to him. And then Rebecca De Mornay, you compare her to Micah Monroe, and it's a really difficult thing to say who did it better. And that's where the original has its problems, and that's where the remake actually manages to gain some ground, but it doesn't surpass it in any way, because Rebecca De Mornay is still terrific. I'm being hard on the remake, I know that, because I love the original, as I've said a million times. But I didn't hate the remake. It still entertained me, and I give it points for that. I enjoyed Martin Starr being slightly kooky and his sort of awkwardness on screen. It always works very well as either him being an asshole or being someone exceptionally nerdy. And I always look forward to seeing him. he livened up the screen when he was on. So I'm in a half of mind to give it quite a good score, but a half of mind just to say it's pale in comparison. If they had called it something else, I think this would have been a better received movie. If it had been, you know, Psycho Nanny or something like that, you might have gone, yeah, all right, I'll watch this. But because it carries the brand Land That Rocks a Cradle, you're like, well, you know, this is following in the shoes of not one of the best thrillers of the 90s, but certainly one of the most competent ones, and a perfect example of a good film from the 90s that invented the career of Curtis Hanson a good bit.
Yeah.
So, yes, I'd say I'd go for six. I think that's fair. Alan?
Six.
Okay.
Okay, so that's 20, isn't it? 12, yeah, 20. So that puts it pretty much in the middle there, with lots of other things that are 20, incidentally, including The Contract, The Stowaway, that Money Heist career thingy, Meantime, yeah, The Pale Blue Eye. Oh, yeah, because we had 20 last time, didn't we, as well? Perhaps this is becoming a bit common. We'll have to change this up. The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. It seems to me that I'm the biggest fan here. And
You're the biggest what here?
I think you're right, though, Gareth. I think much of it was carried because of Maker What's-It, because she was just so sinister and dark, and she did it really well. Anyway, there you go. 20 is the score for that one. So thanks for that. I enjoyed watching that. And I shall move forward on that. We'll move forward to the next show, though, with Alan's choice for what we're going to watch next time while he moves around in his squeaky chair.
His squeaky captain's chair. Make it so, number one. All right, so let's go full warp speed ahead into Arlington Road from 1999, which you can watch on YouTube. It's Tim Robbins and Jeff Bridges. I'm not saying anything more about that. Unless either of you or both of you have an enormous objection to this, in which case I have a contingency called The Opportunists from 1999. Also, full film, watchable for free on YouTube, and it's a Christopher Walken, Cyndi Lauper movie.
Cyndi Lauper?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well.
I've never seen either of these, so Gareth can choose.
I've seen one of them, and you might have to force me to watch the other one. Arlington Road, I've seen that.
Yeah. So I think Arlington Road's a very strong movie. I'd be happy to recommend it. So unless either of you have an objection, I would be keen to hear what you think of it. Or was that an objection, Gareth? Did I just misread what you were saying?
I don't know. Because you and I have both seen Arlington Road, I'm actually leaning toward the opportunists because
Alrighty.
I that haven't seen it, and that'll give us more to talk about. And all Cyndi Lauper's always interesting in movies.
Yeah, well, I can't think of her in anything, so I'm more than happy to do that. And, of course, Christopher Walken's always interesting, even if it's a madcap one. So, right, we'll do The Opportunists then, okay, chaps?
Okay, and I'll try and watch both of them, because I haven't seen the other one, so, yep.
Well, I think you'll enjoy Arlington Road. It's a ripping yarn, and it's absolutely terrific performances and brilliantly scripted story.
Splendid.
But no I would say that perhaps... without giving any spoilers away whatsoever, it's a little too similarly cut to what we're talking about this week.
All right, fair enough.
Ah.
The Opportunists.
Ah, ha, ha, ha. Right, okay then. Thanks very much for that, Alan. We'll move forward with The Opportunists and come back to the next show and talk about that. Gareth, Theme Treats is next, and you were the one to choose a director.
Oh, yes, two weeks ago I had a tough choice. I was either going to go with Joe DiMaggio, Jess Franco, or Martin Scorsese. And, you know, I went with Martin Scorsese, which, out of those filmmakers, he's the least interesting, I'd say.
The least, and probably the least accomplished.
Yes, and I think we'll go with Alan first, because I like his choices better than Ted's.
All right, well, we've got so many to get through, and it's going to be so easy to riff on this. I'll keep these fairly succinct. So Taxi Driver 1976, Robert De Niro, directed by Scorsese, obviously, also featuring Harvey Keitel, and a kind of debut, or more or less a mainstream debut role for Jodie Foster playing a child prostitute in the movie, which is about a taxi driver who's a Vietnam vet. He's completely estranged from society, desperately lonely, suffering from post-traumatic stress. And he becomes fixated on a young sort of political campaigner who's played by Cybill Shepherd, who's absolutely gorgeous in this. Falls in love with her, if you can take a sort of obsessive sexual fixation for love, and tries to date her. When that's thwarted, he his resentment and frustration is kind of vented into an attempted assassination. And it is an extraordinarily powerful character portrait. Made a huge impression on me, both just as a young man, for the kind of sense of like turbulence of being a young man, but also as an aspiring filmmaker, because it was so brilliantly made and so brilliantly acted. The score is also phenomenal. I think it was Bernard Herrmann's last score. This is a film that is just genuinely film school gold, and you could watch it every week and continue to see more wonderful things and learn from it. But it's a very brutal movie. It's a very unpleasant film, and it's just a complete tour de force. Over and above that, then, I would recommend The King of Comedy, which is a 1982 Scorsese-De Niro collaboration with Jerry Lewis. And it's a uncomfortable kind of proto squirm cringe comedy, black comedy, about a completely hopeless comedian who is so deluded and so out of touch with reality. He must be on many spectrums, that he becomes obsessed with Jerry Lewis and thinks that if he can get his material to Jerry Lewis, obviously the great film star, comic actor of the 50s and 60s, who plays himself in this movie, then he'll be able to get to be on his writing staff and do some regular Johnny Carson appearances and so on and so forth. So he collaborates with Sandra Bernhardt to kidnap Jerry and as his ransom to be able to perform his comedy live on the Carson show. And it's a terrific movie. It's just brilliantly acted, brilliantly well observed about the rabid lust for fame and the need for attention, what people will do for it, and the effect than it has on those who have it. And that's, it's a very, very nuanced and subtle performance from Jerry Lewis as well, who most of us know from things like The Nutty Professor, the original one, which was like, you know, a masterpiece of clownish, you know, pratfall comedy and big goofy expressions and way over the top physical comedy. And this is sort of the other end of the spectrum. It shows a very, very curtailed, kind of contained performance that's absolutely riveting. So again, can't recommend that one highly enough. It is a comedy, but it's very uncomfortable. And I've given a link to one of the finest episode or scenes in the movie there, the King of Comedy home invasion scene. It's linked in the YouTube links there in the show notes. And in that, as the title suggests, De Niro and his girlfriend, played by Diane Abbott, who was, I think, De Niro's wife at the time, arrive up at Jerry's house. And De Niro has sort of lied to her to sort of say, look, you know, oh, we've been invited up for a meeting with Jerry. And she's very, very impressed by this. But, of course, it's not true. And De Niro arrives up slightly early before Jerry has returned from golf, much to the consternation of the Japanese housekeeper and eventually Jerry Lewis when he arrives. And the scene, I think, was largely improvised and but the characters had worked together and rehearsed and you know, studied together for about a month prior, so that, you know, all the motivation and all the actions are highly, highly motivated and utterly convincing. It's just a terrific scene. It's maybe 6 or 7 minutes long, but it gives you a good indication for the feel of the movie as a whole. Later on, I'm going to talk a little bit about with you guys about Killers of the Flower Moon, which I'm currently watching, but we'll come to that later on. So any thoughts on those ones, fellas?
Yeah, well, Taxi Driver is an absolute classic. It's been a while since I've seen King of Comedy.
Yeah,
I think it was VHS was the last time I watched that. I have to give it a go again. I don't remember thinking it was brilliant. Too great. But I think I went into it expecting a lighter film.
Totally. So did I.
Getting one.
Yeah, no, it's quite disturbing. But it's a sort of film, a bit like Taxi Driver. It's a film about obsession and the inability to contain your own obsessions and stuff. But it is absolutely brilliant, and all the more pertinent today, you know, with like YouTube and everybody wanting to be an influencer and everybody, as Warhol said many decades ago, getting their 15 minutes of fame and so on. So yeah, Ted, have you seen either of these?
Taxi Driver, yeah, of course I know that very well, and I've watched it lots of times, and now when I try and watch it, I think this is just feeling dated and I can't be bothered watching it anymore. But I think that's probably that's what comes of watching something far too many times.
Excuse me. Yes, indeed, yeah.
King of Comedy, I tried to watch that, and I've tried to watch it 2 or 3 times and I just don't get it and I don't enjoy it and I can't really work out why. I don't know. Possibly because it stinks of American chat show too much, or I don't know. I just didn't get that at all. I think they're
in good company. Siskel and Ebert, when they reviewed it, neither of them liked it. They said, "Look, oh gosh, I can't." I said, "I can rate it. I can see that it's a good film, but I don't like it." And he said he went back to it sometime later, and he said, "Actually, I really appreciate it much more." But the first time around, he was thrown by the lack of sort of goodwill, easy laughs in it.
I just didn't like it. Full stop, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So
can I make it any clearer?
Honestly, I did try. I did try. At least twice I've given it a go and got. Yeah. And I've known people like you who say, you must see it, it's great. And it just missed me. Sorry.
And the same with Dune, you know, the David Lynch Dune. I have tried 3 or 4 times to watch that and always end up in a coma about a third of the way through the movie.
It's crap.
But yeah, it's like, well, anyway, we'll discuss that another time.
Yeah.
So who's next?
Oh, Ted, go for yours.
Okay. I like Taxi Driver. I like Cape Fear, the 1991 one, with, again, Robert De Niro And that's just great, including it being a really tight remake of the 1960-something one, which was also great. And The Age of Innocence, yeah. I watched with glee for Winona Ryder, of course, which is a period piece. Daniel Day-Lewis is in it. And that's it's a long kind of wieldy American historic drama. That's very good. I enjoyed that. But I probably wouldn't have been so enthusiastic if she'd not been in it, to be honest. And the one I wanted to focus on was Hugo, which I've spoken about on the show before, and I've written a bit of a feedback so that I don't miss all my points. So I'll just read it out. Hugo is a 2011. Incidentally, before I start, I will say that I watched a few interviews with Scorsese on YouTube during the week, and he comes across when he's being interviewed as such a nice bloke. I hadn't really got that before. I don't think I'd done that and kind of knew much about him, but he's got this great Woody Allen New York accent, and he just comes across as a really nice bloke. So I warmed to him to begin with. Hugo...
And his bushy eyebrows.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Hugo was his 2011 homage to Georges Méliès, the special effects early movie guru chappy from the 19-something-or-others, 1920s or 30s. And he's made this 3D... movie set basically inside this station clock. So this 3D clockwork fairy tale tells a moving tale of early movie special effects techniques by Georges Méliès through a funny, whimsical, enchanting world of 1930s Parisian train station. The Hugo orphan who scampers around the roof space attending to the station clock. He's isolated and alone, watching the world go by from within the clock. And according to Scorsese in one of those interviews, this somewhat reflects his own life, where he had to sit out and watch as a child, because when he was a kid, he had this asthma thing going on and he wasn't allowed to join in with his mates or do anything. And so he got the idea of someone looking at the world from inside, which is what he had to do.
That's fascinating.
I've never seen this in 3D, which is a real shame, because I would love to, because you can just see, watching it in 2D, how every shot and every scene has been beautifully constructed. You can just see all the cogs and the corners inside the station's clock and how the camera moves between everything. And I can just imagine in 3D, it must have been absolutely delightful. If I get the chance to see it at the cinema, I think I'll take it, because I would love to see this. It's got a delightfully quaint European cinema feel, a bit like Amelie, really. Very different to Amelie, but in terms of the, you know, the look and feel and great storytelling. Outside, there's all this Paris snow going on, and the outside almost looks like it's all CGI as well, but it's been done really, really well. And every scene packed with lovely detail, great Parisian music going on, so lots of accordion-type music. A love letter also to Paris to some degree. So there's no violence from Scorsese. It's more of this kind of love letter to Méliès. Hugo's quest is to fix his dad's automaton, little robot thingy, in order to fix his broken life. So there's the parallel going on, and to restore lost dreams to the lost filmmaker. So Ben Kingsley is playing the Méliès character, and he's working in this shop in the train station. But he's this wonderfully talented filmmaker from the past. And Hugo works to bring all that out through lots of charming, spirited stuff going on, deeply nostalgic. It's character rich too, with fabulous turns from a broadcast with, as I say, Ben Kingsley in one of mostly in the lead role. Sacha Baron Cohen is really funny as the copper policing the train station. Chloe Grace Moritz is in there, Ray Winston, Emily Mortimer, Christopher Lee, Francis de la Tour, Richard Griffiths and Jude Law. And each of them don't have a huge amount of screen time, but when they are in, they've had their characters written for them so beautifully, and they're all so funny. It's warm and it's visually sumptuous. Yeah, it's a fairy tale, really, and it shows that Scorsese can indeed turn his hand to any kind of filmmaking. It's just a gorgeous delight of a film. It's a real, it's a perfect Boxing Day afternoon family film, which no one will dislike. Everyone will just lap it up, and they'll be delighted and charmed by it. So there you go, Gareth. There's no killings in it.
Boring. No, I'm kidding. It does look pretty fantastic, and I like the idea that Martin Scorsese has done something like this, because, you know, it's kind of Steven Spielberg territory, or, you know, it's not his usual wheelhouse, so, you know, you're just not getting a huge, violent gangster movie every time you watch a Scorsese film or something with phenomenal depth. It's just a good family film.
It's lovely. I've seen it in the 3D on a friend's big 4K TV, and it was absolutely beautiful. And I totally agree with everything you said about it. It was just lovely. And again, just compliments to Mr. Scorsese that he can seemingly effortlessly, obviously takes a vast amount of skill and effort and all the rest of it. But I mean, it's a kind of flawless, sweet family movie that's just beautifully made, as you say.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go with this three big crime films. although I was Googling there to check and see. We did do Mean Streets before. Whenever we were talking, I think it was Harvey Keitel. Actually, we touched on Mean Streets.
Way back,
fantastic movie. Yeah. You know, it's one of his, you know, calling card movies. It's incredible to think that he made that at such a young age. And he'd made a couple of films before that, but nothing to this extent. And it's rightfully remembered, although I still haven't gotten around to touching that big 4K box set that Second Sight put out earlier this year. But I will, and I'll live in Mean Streets for a weekend, and I look forward to doing that because there's so much stuff in it.
That fight scene in the pool room is absolutely terrific. Just manic documentary sort of French Connection feel to it. It's brilliant.
Yeah. The next one I kind of want to touch on a bit more is 1995's Casino. Which feels more like a bit of a retread of his other films of this genre. And I did watch it quite recently because I felt that a lot of people were talking about it in the way that it was a misunderstood classic, and it's gotten better with age and things like that. But I don't think it has. It is good, but it's nothing on whenever you compare it to the likes of what he did in 1990 with Goodfellas. That film is just, it still is, it's got to be almost everybody's favorite movie. It's the one film that almost, you know, toppled The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2 as the best gangster film, and that takes something, because those two are just utter classics. And I'm not saying that it does, but I am half saying that it does, because I think on one day you'll get out of bed and go, nah, Goodfellas is better. And then the other day she'll get out and go, nah, Godfather's better. But it's 50-50. I love Godfather. Goodfellas for so many reasons. The simplest reason is actually that it's just continually entertaining and pretty savage. It's one of those films that you never feel the runtime, and it just constantly keeps going. And even whenever I always think of the last act of the film is whenever the helicopters are following and things like that, but it's so far away from that. Whenever you get to that, I always just think, remember, there's plenty more to go.
It accelerates so quickly at that point. I remember thinking he's going to have a heart attack. You know, you had almost felt like you were on coke with him, being chased by the mob and by the FBI.
It was so
pumped with adrenaline.
And you quite happily leave the time period behind and enter a whole new something. It's almost like a decade. You know, they're entering the 80s now or whatever from the 70s, and everything's changed and life is going. But you don't notice it because things are just continually moving. I adore for that. Every line in that movie is just so well done. De Niro's face, whenever he's...
You're a little out of
with
yourself.
With a cigarette.
Yeah. That's an iconic shot for sure.
I'm Ray Liotta's biggest fan in the world. This film is just everything. You know, his performance, I think, is superb. And you know, he's matching up there to Joe Pesci and to Robert De Niro, and he holds it. He does well. He's sort of like the straight man to the funny guys or the comedy guys. You know, he's not the main focus, but he absolutely holds it all together. And it's such great work. Oh, I love Goodfellas. And obviously, soundtrack. Alan, you do too. Oh, yes. Yeah. I think they need to release a volume two of that at some point.
Yeah. It's a flawless film, I think. And the thing is, you know, I remember watching it the first time and thinking, like, I felt bad halfway through the movie because I was going like, oh, I'd love to be a gangster. And then at the you know, like, up until the point where Pesci's going like, what the fuck am I, what, I'm here to amuse you? All that stuff. Up until in the first third of the movie, you're kind of going, I have to admit, it does kind of, you know, it goes like, to us, all the regular guys who just paid their taxes and went to work, they were deadbeats. They were nothing. They had no balls. And then, you know, he says, we were good fellas. If we wanted something, we'd take it. And we'd had our wives, and we had our girlfriends, and we had our cars. And if you're honest, I think, you know, part of you does go like, gosh, man, that I can see the appeal. The end of the movie, I was going, thank God I've never got involved in anything like that. You know, that I've been spared that, because once you're in, you can, I tried to get out, they pulled me back in, or whatever the Pacino thing is. You know, like, there's no escaping that lifestyle. And when you saw the utter destruction that it brought everybody, it's such a great morality tale, because it does give you the bright side of the picture before giving you the dark side, you know. Yeah. And it's horrendously violent and brutal. It doesn't pull any punches either. It's quite shocking in places. But, yeah, terrific movie. Ted, I'm sure we're on the same page.
No, I don't like Goodfellas. I don't tend to...
We're not
like,
talking about the pizzas here. We're talking about the film.
I don't tend to like these mafia-type, Godfather-type films. However, I do make an exception for Casino. I did watch Casino, and I liked Casino, and thought it was really well done and really good. Not quite sure why, because it kind of fits the whole, you know, gangster thing, but it just rung a bell with me. Maybe I watched it at the right time or something. And I did really like that, and I thought De Niro was just fabulous in Casino, and
as was Sharon Stone as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd happily watch that again. I haven't seen it for years. In fact, I probably haven't seen it since I saw it in the cinema in 1995. So there is that. Before we forget, I just wanted to mention The Irishman. Chad Dixon wrote about The Irishman. We had a special, I think, on The Irishman on the projector room podcast, so we won't go into it too much here, but just to mention that it's there as part of the set, and I'll put a link in there to Chad's full review on The Irishman, it will be in the show notes. So yeah, sorry about Gareth, back to you.
No, that about brings it to a close.
Okay.
The Irishman is absolutely terrific, and you know, it's, I think, Alan, you've watched it a number of times, and that goes to show, you know, sitting down and watching it.
Wow.
A 4-hour movie is something that you don't watch too many times lightly.
Yeah. I know. I hope to watch it a few more times. For some reason, I like to watch it over Christmas. I think it's a kind of like a big, cold, rainy afternoon, and you just get a wee glass of scotch and sit down and immerse yourself in that rather unpleasant world again.
Loads of good stuff there.
One glass of scotch for a four-hour movie? Wow.
Well, that's a big glass. A flagon of scotch.
Yeah. Loads of good stuff, though, from Scorsese, and links in the show notes to all of those, so you can be led off to look at all of the lovely films and find your own, too. Alan, on the next show, it's your turn to pick the director for the theme treat. So who is it going to be?
Okay, so it's going to be Edgar Wright, who we might know most famously from the Cornetto trilogy of the work with Nick Frost and Simon Pegg. But he's directed other stuff as well. And the link's in there's a link to his wiki page there in the show notes.
Cool. Okay, Edgar Wright is next time. Now onto the main feature. And I'm going to go first with we spoke about Rust, which has become the Western film most famous for the sad fatal shooting of cinematographer Halnia Hutchins. There was a point at which they kind of thought it wouldn't be finished and wouldn't be made, and it was all, as we know, going through court and various people were being sued and there was talk about jail sentences, blah blah blah, and very, very sad it was indeed, of course, but I'm glad that they actually went on to finish a story. And it's a good solid Western. It works really well. It's about these two boys who are living alone, and the parents are dead or disappeared, and the older boy is looking after the younger boy, and there's an accident that happens, ironically, given the aforementioned, where there's an accidental shooting of a chappie on their land, and the 13-year-old boy Lucas, the older one, he gets taken to jail, and they're going to hang him because they consider that it wasn't an accident, it was done on purpose, which it wasn't. Anyway, along comes our hero, who is Alec Baldwin, playing the character Rust, and breaks him out of jail and goes on the run with him. And from there on, it turns into a kind of road movie on horses, really, where the boy doesn't have a clue what's going on. Baldwin's character, Rust, is an uncle of his, and there's an auntie in the mix as well, and he's trying to get the boy to Mexico out of the way of the American authorities. Usual kind of Western scenario. There's a bunch of lawmen and bounty hunters on their tail. There's $1,000 price put on their heads, so everyone's out to get them, and they go from adventure to adventure, and in some ways it's just a very simple Western types plot with lots of goodies and baddies involved and killings and shooting. And it's all just good fun, really. obviously, as I say, Halnia Hutchins' incident over. And actually, when you get to the end of the film, there's a very moving tribute to her before the credits roll, and some very appropriate music, and they've kind of made a headstone for her almost. I didn't feel as though Alec Baldwin was very well cast in it, certainly at first, but I kind of warmed to him in the end. And I thought that, by the end of it, he was doing quite well. I could have seen a young Clint Eastwood doing it much better, but then that's probably would be obvious, wouldn't it? Really good old-fashioned Western, though. 2 hours, 20 minutes long. The time flew by. It was really, I thought, really well done, and I would recommend it to anyone to seek out. It's currently on, what's it on? I can't remember what it's on. It's on a streaming service, which is where I saw it. Is it Netflix? Can't remember. Anyway, it's out there.
Right. Well, that sounds more positive than I'd anticipated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gaz? Yeah, I do want to see that. It's high up my list. I almost bought the Blu-ray when it came out, but I just thought, it's just going to be one of those crap ones. But now Ted's watched it, dropping it up my list. I'll maybe get the Blu-ray.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right, good who's one. Next?
Yeah. Gaz,
you go for it.
All right. I forgot I was talking about this one. I hadn't seen it before, so I decided to sit down and watch Audition. Which is a Japanese film from the year 2000, directed by Takayasu Mike. And this has always been one of those films that has sat at the top of the notorious lists because it's so bad and nasty. But it's not. I'm here to say that, I'd say about four-fifths of this movie is actually a really involving romantic drama, I suppose, about two characters who are looking for a lady for one of the characters, and they go out and they hatch a scheme to be able to find one and bring her into one of the characters' lives. And then things go very wrong whenever they start to get to know this girl. But see, to be honest, by the time the notorious stuff of this film starts to come about, I was actually thinking, I was quite happy in this wee universe that they created where these two were falling in love.
Right.
I don't want it to go all mental Spencer now. But it does. And, you do already fall in love with the leading lady Shikaru, I can't remember the main guy's name, as he does, and you can understand when things happen and why he goes headlong into this. But Asami, the young girl that he attracts the attention of, is just a phenomenal portrayal of a fruitcake, and there's little bits, there's a line in it that she repeats over and over again during one of the experiences, or during the big experience at the end of the film, where she says "kitty kitty kitty kitty," which means deeper, 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 deeper. It's so lovable, and you're thinking, such a cute word. As well, a little girl saying, or not a little girl, but a young Japanese girl saying "kitty, kitty, kitty, kitty," is very cute. I'm sure I've got it wrong, and it's actually some other slight different pronunciation, but that's what I heard in my ears, and it just made it so cute and adorable. But what she's doing is just utterly bonkers, and the film just tells a really well made story, and I don't rate it up there with Saw or anything like that, or Martyrs or anything that it would frequently appear on the list with. This is something else that just has a bit of a violent, bloody climax, and the majority of the film is quite sane and agreeable. It's lovely. For the most part. Ted, have you seen this?
I've seen it a couple of times, and the first time I watched it, like you, I really didn't know what I was expecting. However, these days they've kind of given it away, because on the poster and on the graphics all over it, you see the girl holding a syringe, and it's just obvious that something is afoot. Anyway, you're quite right. The first time I watched it, I got halfway through it, and I was watching this Japanese drama, and I thought, yeah, this is very nice, lovely, lovely Japanese drama. It's all being done quite well, and blah blah blah. And then suddenly, I was gobsmacked when, because I didn't know any of the background of the film, and suddenly all this started about three quarters of the way in, and I was like, what? And then for the rest of the film, it just turns into this completely bonkers story. I don't want to give anything away, because people should try if they can to watch this. But it just goes Fruit Loop Looney Tunes. However, there is a backstory to it which comes out, and you do see why everyone's doing what they're doing, and there is some logic to it, and you start to see the childhood experiences of this girl, which kind of put it all into perspective to some degree. And I think it's a really good film. It's really well done, and the second time I enjoyed it more. I think I flicked through a lot of the first half.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, I'm surprised it never got a sequel or even an American remake. Because it's one of those big films that people often talk about. But I guess it was kind of groundbreaking that way. And I know that Takeyashi Mike. He became notorious for that, and he even appears in things like Hostel because of his reputation from this film.
And he did Ichi the Killer. And there's a few other ones which are on the list, which I was surprised that it was the same director. But yeah, there's a few there now that now the subject's been opened up again. More to watch.
That's right. Cool. Alan, I take it you haven't seen this.
No, I do. I do generally like Asian films, Korean movies, Japanese stuff, but I know nothing compared to Tedward on it.
And you hide behind the sofas whenever anything starts to get...
Yeah, if there's a girl climbing out of a TV, I hide.
Yeah, that might be an influence on this as well, you know, that whole look. I think she does that a good bit. And I do love the phone in this where she's sitting waiting on the phone to ring. Just because she's in love.
Yeah, we've all been there.
Or is she? Or is she?
Yeah, so I do recommend that. That was a really, really solid film. And I followed it up with another fairly solid film called Lake Placid that I'm sure everybody is seeing.
Do we not talk about Lake Placid in virtually every episode it's touched upon?
I might do.
Is this, you know, Carrie Werler? I seem to remember, like,
no,
if that's the right movie. No, all right.
It's Bridget Fonda and Bill Pullman.
Right. Okay.
But I remember doing the Bruce Campbell podcast, and I did a bunch of research, and I found out that he was up for one of the roles in this. And it's always been, I've always been meaning to sit down and watch it and trying to work out which role it was. And I'm pretty sure that it's the Oliver Platt role, but it could be any of them. You know, they all work. Even Bridget Fonda's one. I'm sure Bill Pullman's romantic subplot with Bruce Campbell would be on everybody's menu.
Yeah, for sure.
But or even Betty White's role. Yeah, interchangeable those two. So Lake Placid is a really, really simple tale of a giant crocodile that is haunting the waters of a black lake up in Maine, which isn't Lake Placid, because Lake Placid's in Florida. And I think they actually make reference to that. And I hadn't clocked that at all. I always thought this took place down the Everglades or something like that. But it's not. It's up in Maine, which is now a state that I'm getting to know quite well. Right. But yeah, it's up there. And yeah, this giant crocodile starts chomping on people. But the film has such a sly wit to it as well. Brendan Gleeson, who I would say is actually the star of this film. It's no one else. It's just Brendan Gleeson. He's the most memorable character in it. And, well, maybe besides Betty White. And he's in every scene and has all the best lines. And all the funny things happen to him. So, you know, it makes you think that Bill Pullman... he has no real reason to be there other than just be sort of a handsome hero. If it had just been Brendan Gleeson and Oliver Platt go crocodile hunting up in Maine, it would have been fantastic. But the film is ridiculously lean. It's 82 minutes, and everything I think that could possibly bog it down is just chopped out of it. So it just moves. It goes, it happens, it entertains, it's got a bit of action here and there. The CGI isn't too bad. It just, you know, it's a crowd pleaser. Yeah. I really like this. And I've always liked it. Every time I've watched it, it's been a decent little film to enjoy. And I'm trying to work out if either of you two have actually seen it.
I saw it in the cinema.
It's great. So did I think.
I remember thinking it was great fun, and sort of, like it's a well-made B movie, isn't it? Monster movie.
Yeah.
Yes. It's
colors on its collar.
It's almost not B though, because of the cast and the money that it's completely absurd. Because this crocodile is so gigantic, it's just ridiculous. You know, the whole idea of it is just nutty. It's like Jaws on a lake. But it's just really funny and it's really well done. And every time I see it, I think, yeah, it's a real good Friday night film. And
exactly.
You want to have a right old laugh with it. So, yeah, good shout, Gareth.
Yeah, and I think it came at a time whenever you were getting the likes of Deep Blue Sea and Godzilla and stuff like that. So monster movies were coming back, and this was one that just decided to do it with the tongue in its cheek and not lampoon them, but you can have fun both ways, giggling and being frightened by it. Well, yeah, I can't imagine too many people being frightened by it.
Yeah. Maybe 5-year-olds.
Well, yeah, I thought it was quite frightening. don't care for your bullying tone.
If the crocodile wasn't quite so big, you might get a bit frightened, I suppose.
It's a fun movie. It's a fun monster movie. Yeah, no harm in it. Yeah,
cool. Very good. That's right, Alan, what about you?
So, if you recall, I loved the first season of Tulsa King.
Yes.
Sorry to say, season 3, I couldn't make it past the first 2 episodes. And actually, that took a couple of goes, really. It took a bit of effort. I love Sylvester Stallone, generally. Neil McDonough is terrific in it. Max Casella is another wonderful actor who's really top class in the movie. In the series. But it's just... just is aggravating. It's very, very weak. The ensemble stuff with Sylvester's entourage just feels cheesy. It's a lazy way to describe it, but it's actually the most accurate. And there's too many villains who are somewhat diluted, I think, by the absence of the actor who was, what was his name? Dominic Lombardozzi, who was the initial a villain of the first season, who was absolutely terrifying and really, really terrific as the sort of jilted son of the Italian mafia boss in New York. So it was a little bit like in Gladiator, when Marcus Aurelius dies and Joaquin Phoenix's son. His son, played by Joaquin Phoenix, has to step up to the mark, and he's just evil and corrupt and thwarted. And Dominic Lombardozzi plays this sort of Charles Chicky character brilliantly. And I think his absence has just made the whole thing sort of come apart. Maybe they're just kind of flogging a dead horse. It just doesn't feel even and convincing. There's just not enough jeopardy. Same thing happened to a lesser extent, I think, with... the big Alan, what do you call it, Reacher show that we watched recently. First season was absolutely terrific, and second season was enjoyable enough if you were in a forgiving mood. Third season was pretty weak, really, to be fair. So, sadly, I can't recommend that. Next up, we've been talking about Scorsese, and I haven't been able to give a whole lot of attention to some of the other set pieces for tonight. So I happened upon Killers of the Flower Moon when I realized that my Apple Plus was still active. And I thought, you know what, it'd be a good time to watch that. Have you seen it, Gareth?
No, I haven't yet, actually.
Killers of the Flower Moon. So it's DiCaprio, De Niro, and a Native American actress called Lily Savage, I think it is. I need to double check on that.
Lily Savage.
She's a pop star, isn't she?
Pop star?
Sorry, sound like
a transvestite drag act.
There you go. Yeah. So I'll get the name of the actors here for you. But essentially, the blurb is, at the turn of the 20th century, oil brought a fortune to the Osage Nation, who became some of the richest people in the world. Overnight, the wealth of these Native Americans immediately attracted white interlopers who manipulated, extorted, and stole as much Osage money as they could before resorting to murder. Based on a true story and told through the improbable romance of Ernest Burkhart, played by DiCaprio, and Molly Kyle, I beg your pardon, played by Lily Gladstone. Killers of the Flower Moon is an epic Western crime saga where real love crosses paths with unspeakable betrayal. It's got De Niro, Jesse Plemons, John Lithgow, Brendan Fraser, Tantu Cardinal, Cara J. Mayers, Janae Collins, and Gillian Dion. And it's directed by Archa Marty. with a screenplay by Eric Roth and Scorsese, based on David Graham's best-selling book. And the thing is, it's a whopping 3.5 hours long, and it is... It's an excellent film. I mean, the historical recreation of the Wild West, Oklahoma, is, well, it's not pure Wild West. It's not like 1880s. It's like, say, 1919, that sort of time. Is really immersive and totally convincing. But the problem with that is, like, that's a harsh world to be sort of steeped in for 3.5 hours. And it is a litany of brutal murders of innocent people. For the most venal of reasons. So it's not an enjoyable film particularly. It's an absolutely brilliantly made, excellent film, but it's not particularly enjoyable. DiCaprio is brilliant. All the acting is absolutely magnificent. One thing I would say is, like, there's a couple of references to DiCaprio being sort of a young man, or, you know, a boy and stuff. Like, he's supposed to be a soldier just back from World War One. And, he's clearly well into middle age, you know, throughout. So that is a little bit of a stumbling block. But it's very good. And I've got about 20 minutes of the movie left to watch. And so look at, you know, it's one of those ones, a bit like The Irishman. It's an epic tale of sort of the horrors of how evil and duplicitous people can be. And the central contradiction of the movie is that, DiCaprio seemingly loves his Native American wife, but is completely up to, you know, he's completely complicit in these premeditated murders of her own family. And to some extent, you know, I'm still kind of like trying to work out, is he psychotic and just, I mean, because he seems to be partaking in her poisoning as well, at the behest of her uncle, played by De Niro, because they all stand to then, if they're married into the families, they stand to inherit the land, which is worth, you know, I mean, I think nearly billions in the original currency. So yeah, it's a hard watch, very, very well made. And there's a kind of slightly incongruous blues, almost like a Ry Cooder sort of blues, Delta blues music going through, which I'm sure, you know, has been particularly well chosen for some historical reason. But there's a particular riff in it, which is, it's like a heartbeat on a big upright double bass, and it creates a lot of tension. Works very well. Have either of you seen it?
No, I think the main reason why I didn't go for it was because there's not many people who are talking about it in the way that they talked about The Irishman.
Yeah.
And I think that's, there was a lot of talk about The Irishman when it came out, and you know, people saying it was sort of mediocre to great, whereas this
yeah,
one,
it was mixed reviews,
it wasn't
wasn't
even
it?
That. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a so solid film, but
it's a lot to bite off.
Yeah, and it is just less glamorous. The Irishman, despite the fact that it is a brutal film, has a lot, you know, it's the backdrop of Cuba, it's the Vegas mobsters, it's what do you call the fella who, Jimmy Hoffa, all that kind of stuff. So So there's a lot of kind of pyrotechnics and historical period interest in it as well. This is a lot of mud and, you know, hangings and brutal murders in this. You know, it's a dark, dark, grimy picture, but extremely well made. On a brighter note, and I won't give any spoilers, I've caught the first two episodes of Pluribus, which, if you remember, was in our Coming Soon recently, and I said, well, I didn't know really what to make of the trailer, but given that it was Rhea Seahorn and Vince Gilligan reteaming, who brought us A Better Call Saul, and I think, you know, Vince Gilligan Breaking Bad, I thought, definitely, this is of interest. I haven't seen TV that I've enjoyed more in the probably 5 or 6 years. I can't think of anything that I thought was as good as this. It is kind of in my wheelhouse because it's got a nutty kind of premise, but it's so brilliantly written and acted and directed that you just buy into it. And even though the story takes crazier and crazier turns, it does so with such skill that you have this kind of thing of like, what? I've got to find out what happens next. So I was very frustrated, came home from work the other night, Really looking forward to watching the third episode, only to find that, you know, I have to wait like the best part of a week for it to come on. And isn't that a lovely treat to actually have to go back to those days of having just to wait patiently?
No.
And then you're going to sort of hoover up the next episode. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's terrifying. It's thought-provoking. It's outlandish. And it's laugh-out-loud funny.
Okay. All good. Right. Yeah. I was waiting because I knew that was going to be a thing. So yeah. Waiting, you know, 4 or 5 weeks so that you can just crank them out.
Yeah,
I'm sure, Ted, you're doing the same thing.
I am doing exactly the same thing. I can't bear to have to do what you're doing, Alan. So yeah. I'll just wait.
And like Rhea Seahorn, how in the world she kept this performance together? Because the emotional register of the first two episodes is just ferocious. And she's just brilliantly sustaining that and selling every ludicrous scene with utter conviction. It's amazing and, as I say, hilarious as well by turn.
Great. I shall look forward to it enormously.
I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Right, okay, anything else?
No. But Ted, so help me, if you turn up and say, it's just an annoying American comedy, I will. I don't know what will happen.
I think given the caliber, I think that's highly unlikely.
Yeah,
and exactly. The history of everyone involved in it. And given that we've been looking forward to this on this show for about 18 and a half years, I think that it would be a very, very unlikely event. Coming soon. Let's hear about the stuff that's coming soon, Gareth.
All right. Well, we'll start with something a little different. And I've got a funny feeling that this might be one that Ted might be interested in. But I threw it in there anyway because the trailer was quirky enough. That's right. He doesn't like that word, quirky. I'll take that back. It was a bit peculiar. The Love That Reigns, which is a new film, 2025, from... Norway, I think, or Denmark.
Scandinavia,
or,
somewhere, isn't it? Yeah,
up there, that direction, which captures a year in the life of a family as parents navigate their separation. Through intimate vignettes and strange occurrences, the film explores the complexities of family, love, and the impact of shared memories. It doesn't sound too much from that, but if you go and actually watch the trailer... the trailer has such a sense of humour about itself. I want to see the film.
Yeah,
December 17th. Ted, yeah. What do you think?
I go along with that. I think it looks interesting. More of a kind of fly-on-the-wall documentary in some ways, but it also had a feel of a Mike Lee film about it, perhaps without any nastiness and underbelly stuff. The scenery looks stunning, which will rescue it as well. And, I think it might be a good watch. I couldn't quite work out why there was an upskirt shot halfway through the trailer, could you?
because he's going on about being horny the whole time.
Yeah, I suppose so.
And that generally does it.
Guess so.
Okay. Well, from that to another one, which actually popped up in the local news here in Belfast, because I believe that Lucy Liu was given some kind of reward for appearing in this film and doing some good work. It's called Rosemead and In a Race Against Time. And that's far too exciting a voice for this kind of movie. An ailing woman discovers her teenage son's violent obsessions and must go to great lengths to protect him and possibly others. In this portrait of a Chinese-American family inspired by true events, Alan, what do you think? Could you take Lucy Liu in a very serious role?
Certainly. I thought the trailer was interesting and looked character-driven and convincing. So, yes, I have a feeling this is the one that was maybe shot on my street, part of it, recently.
No.
Well, I'll say recently, a couple of years ago. It was a different one, was it?
Yeah, I could even tell you what that was because it came out a while ago.
Oh, right. What was it?
I think we discussed it on here.
Oh, right. Sorry, I maybe have just forgotten that. But anyway, yes, this looked good. So Jeremy Irons might have been in it. Right. At any rate, yes, that I thought that this looked well worth a watch.
Yes. Yes, why not? Ted?
I agree. It looks fabulous. And who knew that Lucy Liu could be such a good actress? I mean, we've only seen the trailer, right. But I think it's fairly obvious from the light, fluffy stuff she normally does, like Ally McBeal and
Charlie's Angels.
Charlie, Kill Bill. but yeah, hey, I mean, it looks fabulously well made. It looks moving and engaging. And I kept thinking about, we need to talk about Kevin, the 2011 film, which I think it shares some kind of baseline story stuff with. So yeah, good pick. Like it.
Okie doke. All right, well, next up, that's two so far, folks. Are you listening? I like two of these so far. Let's see if we can spoil that with this next one. I did some research, actually, into this, because way back when, on show number 116, I think it was, because I haven't noted it down, we reviewed Man vs. Bee and gave it 6 out of 10, because all three of us agreed it was actually all right. So Rowan Atkinson heard this and scurried away and decided to write a follow-up. And it took him 3 years, but we now have Man vs. Baby, which is a TV series that's arriving on December the 11th onto Netflix. And it's described as, after a disastrous experience, house-sitting a high-tech mansion hampered by an inconvenient insect in Man vs. Bee, half of the synopsis here is about the previous film.
Yep.
Trevor Bingley, because he had a name apparently, now finds himself looking after a luxurious London penthouse with another unlikely companion he didn't ask for. And I'm guessing that companion is a baby by the title.
Could be onto Ted, something there.
We're going to go with you because you love comedies.
This one looks all right, actually. I'm guessing you thought I would hate this, but I found myself laughing during this trailer. Syrupy, sickly sweet as it may be, it looked like another perfect Boxing Day afternoon family film to me. Oh no, it's a series, isn't it? Well, I'm not sure how long they can keep the jokes going for a whole series, but Rowan Atkins is just always watchable and unlikable, I reckon. And on top of that, it looks like it's the comedy's been well written. I just don't know if it's going to have the legs for a whole series. But yes, British, Royal Britannia, stiff upper lip.
Roar us out like the cat of your chips, salmon.
Can I say, Alan? This is not my bag? No, I do love Rowan Atkinson in the Blackadder stuff, the radio stuff, and all the Blackadder series were excellent. I find Mr. Bean to be insufferable, and this is too close to Mr. Bean for me. It's just not my bag. I think I certainly agree with Ted that it'll be very well written and performed, and it will be funny. It's just not my cup of tea.
Yeah, but we have to remember that we each gave this 6 out of 10 with a total of 18 out of 30, which is quite high.
It's quite respectable.
On our scale.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have to admit, I can't help but think that this is just going to be an absolute tragedy. and the more I was thinking about it, I remember having a problem with the original one, because it felt like it was a feature film that they had made as a feature film and chopped it up into, was it 10-minute episodes or something like that, or 20-minute episodes?
No, 10-minute,
to make it a TV series out of it, whereas this might be more structured and written with a TV series.
A short comic feature film. Remember The Plank?
Yeah.
You know, back in the 70s, was a sort of, I think, an hour-long, something of that nature, kind of like
Eric Sykes and
Mark Rowe. Just a sort of, you know, protracted comedy, slapstick comedy. I think maybe something like that might have... I think we're all on the same page that we're not entirely sure that the, you know, serial version of this is going to work.
Yeah. I looked into The Plank. I think they remade it again. There was a version in the 70s and then another one in the 80s or something.
Was Ronnie Barker involved in one of them?
Possibly. I can't remember who was in. Right. It was Eric Sykes and Arthur Lowe in one of them, and then
another
comedy troupe who was equally agreeable in the other one. Or it might have been Tommy Cooper, was it? I don't know. Yeah.
Let me look it up while we're chatting here.
Lay that down.
That's what you'll be watching tonight. The next one is a desert-based thriller that I was attempting to articulate earlier because I have a passion for these kind of modern-day westerns. This one's called Blood Star, and it's about a petty thief driving through New Mexico desert to find herself the target of a psychopathic small-town sheriff who views his badge as a license to prey on vulnerable young women. She must use all of her street smarts to survive.
Wait a moment. Wait a moment. I've seen this.
Waiting. Oh, what?
And I've reviewed it. How is this thing coming soon? I reviewed it.
Digging the Matrix.
I reviewed this in February 25, and I likened it to Wolf Creek. And I must have watched it on I did watch it on a streaming service. How is this just? Is it because it's only just getting a cinema release or something? I don't know. But I've looked it up, and sure enough, there's my review sitting there.
That's right, okay. Odd. It is. It is absolutely.
It was a great film.
Oh well.
I have to say it was really, really good, and I'll put a link in to my review into the show notes, and it's a real cracker of a film, very Tarantino and very Wolf Creek-ish. We spoke about Wolf Creek before, didn't we? So you'll love this, Gareth, and Alan will hate it.
Right, okay, I guess I'll be able to track it down.
I did think that I thought it looked like a pretty good trailer, yeah, for a sort of violent thriller, yeah, looked okay.
Okay. I'm just noticing it said 2025 in the trailer and then 2024 on IMDb.
Yes, that's right. It does, doesn't it?
Right, okay. Well, it must be getting a re-release or it's arriving in a new territory where it's been marketed. Okay, fair enough. Stunned, corrected, but I'll be able to track it down and review it for the next show.
Hurrah.
Right. Next up is one for Alan, because I know he's going to have a problem with this one. There is a new Star Trek TV series on
its way. I didn't even watch the trailer. I couldn't bring myself. I'm not joking. I just went, no. I saw your show notes. I went, nope. I'm not going to sully my soul with this.
It looks quite good, actually, Alan.
I respect your position, my honourable friend.
I thought that the special effects and the kind of the setting of it looked really pretty good. Holly Hunter's in there, and she looked pretty good. And there is a danger that because it's set in this kind of teenage academy, it might turn into a snotty teen drama. But it felt as though from the trailer that it probably wouldn't do that. But I don't know. I'm just surprised that you weren't on for this.
It's revisiting this crime scene where a loved one was murdered. That's how I feel about it.
Right, okay.
Well, I'll introduce it for the benefit of the listeners so they can know what we're talking about. Yeah. Paramount is seeing it fit to crap out a rather dribbly and warm Starfleet Academy TV series, which follows young cadets training to become Starfleet officers while dealing with friendships, rivalries, and romance, all while facing a mysterious threat to both the Academy and the Federation. Don't get me wrong, folks, I do like my Star Trek, but I do actually stand with Alan, and everything that I've seen of a modern-day Star Trek is painful. And they're doing exactly what Star Wars has kind of done, but on a slightly smaller scale, and shoehorning in, familiar faces along the way. I will say that, you know, Paul Giamatti appears in this trailer, and that makes me a wee bit excited. Yes, obviously, we like Holly Hunter as well. But I happen to know quite well that Robert Picardo, who was in Star Trek.
Yeah, something back in the 90s. Was he in? He was in the one with.
Was
it Voyager? Was it Voyager? He was in. Yeah, he was very good. He was very good, and he actually had he did an episode or two of The Orville as well, in which he was excellent.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. But it also has Stephen Colbert, the late night talk show host.
No, nope, he's a wanker.
Interesting casting. He's a wanker. Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And you're the one who was talking about language earlier on.
Mm. Yeah, I was only joshing.
I'm not terribly excited about this TV series, but I figured that it might get a wee bit of an interesting conversation going between the two of you, and it did. And it's interesting to hear that Ted is for it and Alan's against it.
Who'd have thought?
The Plank, 1967, is a British slapstick comedy directed and written by Eric Sykes and does not feature any of the cast of Star Trek. It stars Sykes, Tommy Cooper, and Jimmy Edwards. And then there was another one where Eric Sykes plays the Arthur Lowe version and Tommy Cooper plays the Eric Sykes role. So just to steer us back out of the warp hole of Star Trek.
Fair enough. But, and Eric Sykes made a number of those as well. There was the one where he played a police officer too. I can't remember what that was called. And there was a,
what was what was the sitcom? It was called Sykes, wasn't it? With Happy Jakes?
Yeah.
I remember always wanting to watch that, and then for some reason, you know, it was never funny.
No.
I don't remember it ever being funny, but I always wanted to watch it.
But it was comfortable. It was a really comfortable
That's
show.
It exactly, Gareth. That's it exactly. And Hattie Jakes was like a nice, jolly auntie that you might have had or something.
Indeed.
And you were just eating your sausages and fried eggs.
Yeah, the cycle. Yeah.
And
you did like Sykes, yeah?
Sykes, yeah. Sykes was a super. Yeah. I remember watching that as a child.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
Cool. All right, well, the last one, I've got a funny feeling Alan's going to hate and Ted's going to love again. this is called Chainsaws We're Singing. There's not much of a plot line to this, but it's the plot line is described as adventures await when new lovers are separated by a chainsaw killer. It's a musical horror film.
It's quite a good tagline.
With the blood-soaked musical of your dreams. Ted?
It looks like an absolute scream. A kind of, I mean, clearly no one involved is taking it seriously. They're all having a laugh. It's all tongue-in-cheek, turning the Chainsaw Massacre into a musical. I mean, what's there not to love, frankly? It looks fabulous, and I'm going to love it. And I shall sit there with my pint of lager, laughing my socks off.
Yeah, it smacks to me. It looks like the kind of thing that fifth formers would have raved about, you know. So Ted has made my case for me. Actually, I'd happily join Ted for a tinny and watch it with him. But I think it's one of those things, like, it would be good fun to watch with a buddy, but I couldn't bear to watch this on my own and take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really,
all right.
Really good selection, Gareth, I have to say.
Yeah.
No buddy cop crap or rubbish American comedy bollocks, but some really good choices.
But there was always the ubiquitous shark theme creeps in somewhere, isn't it? Yeah, swims up from the depths.
Yes. Okay, we're done then. Thanks a lot for that, Gareth. Coming Soon was great this time. Final Curtain is what we have before we go, which is a little bit packed, I'm afraid.
Mm. Yes, it is, absolutely. And we'll start with Techeki
Karyo.
Sorry, Karyo. I don't know what stopped there. Techeki Karyo, who is a well-known French actress, or actor, well, Turkish actor, sorry. I always thought he was French up until I saw an interview with him where he was talking about his name, of all things. But he grew up in Paris, so that's why he has a dynamically French accent to him. He's well known from a great many films. I particularly know him from Nikita with Arla Femme Nikita, the classic Luc Besson actioner, and Bad Boys. He was also in The Patriot and Wing Commander. He was the best part of Wing Commander. He delivers a solidly good performance in Wing Commander. He's also in GoldenEye and Operation Dumbledrop and Cry Freeman. I don't think there's ever been a point where this man has been out of work because he's such a damn good actor. Obviously, you guys know him as well, don't you?
Yeah, very
no,
well.
I didn't. I didn't know him. I've seen him in a lot of those films, but I didn't know his name.
Yeah, I came to know him best when he was doing Baptiste, which I think made it to the BBC in the end, where he played this kind of detective, troubled detective in France, and that was a really good series. But yeah, lots of good stuff. 1492, Conquest of Paradise, Alan.
Yeah, I enjoyed that movie. Yeah. I thought it was very good.
Very sad.
Yeah, it was. He passed away to cancer at the age of 72, which is very, very sad to hear. Hmm. Next up is June Lockhart, who we all know from Lost in Space, who played Maureen Robinson. A well-known face on television. We also got her in the likes of Lassie as well, and a bunch of other TV shows and projects over the years. General Hospital was one that she was in for a good long time in the 1980s, I suppose, late '80s, early '90s. I remember in a movie called The Big Picture as well, where she had a very small but fun cameo.
It's a comedy about an aspiring film director, yeah?
It is, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I love
it's got
that
all
movie.
The short films at the start that are absolutely plastered and
symbolism and games of chess and
cameos, yeah, that's right. And Chud 2, Bud the Chud, which is a cracker of a horror film from the 80s. She made quite a lot of horror films over the years. She was in Troll as well.
With Jennifer Aniston. Was she in that? Or am I thinking of Leprechaun?
No.
Yeah.
That's Leprechaun, Leprechaun 3.
Right.
Dead Woman in Lingerie, which I watched recently, and I was a bit disappointed by that because it's not got very much lingerie in it.
Move on.
But obviously you guys know her. I've got a funny feeling the two of you loved Lost in Space. Alan, maybe you more so?
Look, I'm sorry to disappoint. I'm slightly embarrassed to say I've never seen the original Lost in Space. I know. I did enjoy the remake recently, but I was not...
Wow.
I did not know June Lockhart. I did not know her, no.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have, you put up a nice picture there of her in the original Lost in Space, but I wouldn't have known who she was.
There's lots of lingerie in Butterfly, Gareth. The 1981 film with Piers Adora in, and I didn't realise that June Lockhart was in it.
Yes.
To be honest, my VHS tape of that was worn out a long time ago. I didn't know that June Lockhart was in that, and I learned that this week from this this incident. Incidentally, she was 100 years old.
Wow, that's class.
Yeah.
Wow, I've just remembered Butterfly. I remember picking it up because of the cast. That's
exactly.
Right. Stuart Whitman, James Francisco, Stacey Keach, and Orson Welles.
You were focusing on all the chaps.
All led by Piers Adora.
Piers Adora, with the kit off most of the time.
Piers Adora was incredibly cute and sexy.
Yeah, yep. She was.
But we should keep this respectful.
Yeah, sorry.
The context. Yes. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yep. Well, the next one up we have is Diane Ladd, who's well known for the old Nick Cage movie Wild at Heart, and she was in Chinatown, Joy, Scorsese's Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That was Scorsese, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or am I getting it? No, that's all right. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Yeah, very well-known actress.
She was brilliant in that. Yeah. She was one of my, like, her character in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, I just thought was wonderful as a sort of, aging, worked into the ground waitress, in a sort of transport calf in Arizona or whatever it is, in New Mexico they were. She was fantastic in it.
I have seen that.
Yeah. Wild at Heart, I'm not keen on that movie. Chinatown, obviously, we were talking about last week and what a terrific movie it was in it. So.
She was.
I remember years ago sitting down with my stepdaughter, and she put a movie on Sky because Jurassic Park had just happened, and she or was it Jurassic Park? Yeah, well, I think it was Jurassic Park had just happened, and she was in a bit of a dinosaur thing. We put on a film called Carnosaur. That was obviously a direct-to-video knockoff, and it starred Diane Ladd
and Bruce.
No, he wasn't in it, unfortunately.
Right.
But, you know, it was just one of those things of, wow, how did she end up doing this? She's so much better than this. Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry, Ted.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say she was 89, but she was Laura Dern's mum as well, which I didn't know. Oh. Did you mention that already? Sorry.
I didn't know that, no.
Okay. Who was also in Jurassic
Park. Was she related to Alan Ladd? Was she the daughter of Alan Ladd? Or?
Don't know.
Oh, I don't know.
Alan Ladd from Shane?
Don't know.
Yeah. He had his own studio as well, with the tree at the start, which would go down the screen.
Yeah.
That Robocop produced or something. I can't remember. Yeah, well, while you're looking that up, we'll move on to Pauline Collins, Charlie Valentine herself. Classic British actress that everybody knows. And Shirley Valentine was such a huge hit. I don't know if it was in the States, but it certainly was here. Everyone was talking about it. I remember my parents actually going out to the cinema to watch it.
Oh, it was a cultural phenomenon.
Cinema together. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And they definitely loved it. That was a mega hit, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it took a lot for parents to actually go out at the end of the 80s and early 90s, especially whenever there were, you know, advancing years like mine were, for them to actually go to the cinema. Jurassic Park came out soon after that, and they weren't interested in the slightest. But,
they can't have been that old in 85, for flip's sake.
I was 89, wasn't it?
Oh, was it? Oh, sorry, yes, I'm misreading that she died at the age of 85. Right, yes, yeah. But still, 89 was a long time back. I don't know. Yes, that was a very
Ted, I've got a funny feeling you would be, because she was in Liver Birds and things, wasn't she? And that was one of your
favorites. Was she in Liver Birds? She wasn't regularly, was she? Or was she one of them? Was she one of their mums?
Maybe. I remember seeing the name of it on her.
Okay.
She was in five episodes. Yeah.
I've
forgotten about that show. Holy smokes, that hits me in the feels.
Yeah.
Neris Hughes, that is going back, man.
Mm-hmm. Shirley Valentine, obviously, as you say, everyone knows that, and everyone's seen it, I think. Everyone in the whole world has seen it. Upstairs, Downstairs, she went to, which I kind of... She was one of... She ended up being one of these jobbing actors, almost, that was in everything and had a go at everything, and a good, solid British actress who... she was even in a Woody Allen film, You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, where she didn't have a huge part in the film, but she had a significant role, and it was funny to watch her in it. She certainly was loved by many.
Yeah, and to bring it back to Arthur Lowe, she was the narrator of the Little Miss TV series, because he did Mr. Men.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
And both the Liver lasses are still with us, I'm happy to report.
There was three. What about the third one? Because after the first series, the Polly character, is it Polly? They changed.
Polly's still with us, and Neris Hughes is still with us.
But they changed one of them in the second series, then there was a third actress involved. Anyway, that's another topic.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll go for another leading lady as well, because it's very sadly we have lost another leading lady. Sally Kirkland died just yesterday. An absolutely gorgeous lady, never, ever out of work. And looking at this, actually 270 titles to her credit, which is incredible. Where do I start? I watched her in JFK quite recently. Admittedly, like most people in JFK, quite a small role. But she was in The Sting, and I think Anna would be her biggest film that she's best known for. I think she might have got a few Oscar nods or whatever for that. And then Tom in America. Just looking through all these films, it's just an incredible amount of them. And so many that you just can't believe that she moved from one to the next. You know, she would go from Murder, She Wrote one week to The Nanny the next week, but then also appearing in the likes of Brave New World with Spock himself, and Felicity, the TV series, and lots and lots of movies. Do you have any particular favourites? Some dudes?
I did not know the lady. Seems to be my nightmare not knowing these folks. I will have seen her in many of these things, but if had you said Sally Kirkland, I would have gone, yes, who is that? Remind me.
So, yeah, I'm with you, Alan, I'm afraid. I've not heard of her. And completely off my radar. But I'm sure that if I had a look through, I would. I mean, I can see Roger Moore, and presumably that's the Bond film she's in. So I would have seen...
No, she was in Bullseye with Michael Caine and Roger Moore.
Oh, okay. I'm sure that I would have seen her, same as Alan, but no, I'm sorry, I can't put a face to the name, or couldn't have done before now.
Okay. Richard III, well, one with Ian McKellen.
I saw that. I did. Yeah. I remember watching it. It was a weird film.
Is it a Derek Jarman or something like that?
I remember it being
Richard III. Biopic of Richard III.
Yeah, I remember it being very odd. Unless I'm thinking of the wrong film.
Richard III.
Okay.
Film.
It's
directed by Olivier, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, no, sorry, that's the 1955 one.
Scott Anderson.
Right, okay. Right.
Oh, it's not that Richard III I'm thinking of. Okay, it's not the Ian McKellen one. It's one with David Carradine.
Oh, it says he is in the... anyway, yes, right, okay. David Carradine, right. I don't know.
Okay.
There's no shortage of them.
The third's mixed up as well.
Is it the 95 one, which is directed by Richard Loncrean?
No, it's 2007, actually.
2007.
And it's an action crime drama. Okay, I'm standing corrected. It's nothing to do with Shakespeare, right? Okay.
Oh, I see. Right, Scott M. Anderson. Right, okay.
So the last one we have to talk about is one of the biggest names in cinema, and that is
Sorry to let you down again, but I have dropped the ball tonight. Another big name in cinema, I don't know.
Oh, really? Oh, well, you'll have to go back and watch some of his greatest hits, because he stars in the lights of Yakimbo.
All right, okay.
Harakiri. Big Japanese epics. Ran is a particular favorite of many, and the Human Condition series as well. Did you hear those?
So I have seen his work. I watched, I think, Ran last year or the year before, and some other stuff. Let me see what else.
He worked with Kurosawa. On a number of films back in the 60s and 70s.
So I have seen his stuff. Very handsome guy, but I'm afraid to say I just hadn't taken on the scale of his sort of stardom.
You see, I think I like Japanese cinema, but I think I'm more likely to know stuff that's more modern than. I mean, some of this stuff is newer. I grant you, but the big stuff seems to be the 60s, 70s and 80s. You know, The Human Condition. I think I got a feeling I've seen that, but I'm much more likely to have watched Japanese cinema if it was, you know, in the last 15 years, say, or 20 years. Mm. And I'm afraid that I've not heard of this person either, Gareth, so sorry.
Okay, all right. I remember watching a film back in the 80s that I thought was a sequel to a classic, but it certainly wasn't, and it was called Return to the River Kwai.
And no relation?
Ridden the River Kwai. No. It had the River Kwai in it, and I think Edward Fox, and I thought, ooh, he has a habit of taking over Richard Burton rules, and maybe Alec Guinness rules or something like that, or being recast and stuff, but it was nothing to do with it. But he was in that. He had a fairly juicy role in that.
Right. Yep. It was a very crowded room, wasn't it?
What year was that?
89, probably. No, 89,
Oh, yeah,
yes.
Return from the River Kwai. Have I seen that?
Where's Ben? That's right, that's a guy who's
in. Timothy Ben Bottoms. George Takei. There's a Star Trek link, look. in this.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Right. Okay. No, sorry. I don't know this chap, but it's very sad. And he was 92, apparently. And some of those 1960s films actually look really interesting. So more homework and stuff to put on my watch list. Thanks very much, everyone, for your time. We're running very long today. So lots of good content. And you'll find links to all of that stuff on our website in projectorroom.co.uk. You'll also find it in your podcatcher, if I do the show stuff right. TedSalmon.com is where you'll find me, all the links to our audio podcasts and all of our MeWe groups, GarethMiles.com for Gareth and all his lovely film reviews. And that's about it, really. Do join us in the MeWe group. Let us know what you've been watching. And we'll talk about lots of it that we have time to talk about on the shows going forward. So we'll see you in a fortnight's time for more of Projector Room.